Good day, and welcome to the Cigna Eating Disorder Awareness Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Kate Harner. Please go ahead.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. Thank you for calling into Cigna's Eating Disorder Awareness Series. My name is Kate Harner, and I'm a care manager for the Eating Disorder team at Cigna. Due to the format of this call, we will not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of the conference, you will be transferred into a brief five-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. After this brief survey, you will be able to ask questions about the seminar. A handout for today's presentation is available online at www.cignabehavioral.com. On the left-hand side of the screen, click on Visit Our Education and Resource Center. Then click on Eating Disorder Education and Resources. And finally, click on Eating Disorder Awareness, a Cigna educational series. At the top of the screen next to today's date, you'll find a link for today's handout. Again, visit us online at www.cignabehavioral.com. On the left-hand side of the screen, click on Visit Our Education and Resource Center. Then click on Eating Disorder Education and Resources. And then click on Eating Disorder Awareness, a Cigna education series. At the top of the screen, by today's date, you'll find the link for today's handout. And now I have the pleasure of introducing our speaker for today, Mr. Chase Bannister. He is the Vice President and Chief Clinical Officer at Veritas Collaborative, a center of excellence for the treatment of eating disorders. Today, he'll be sharing his presentation with us entitled Understanding the Refeeding Process and Other Difficulties Involved in Eating Disorders Treatment. Welcome, Mr. Chase Bannister.
Thank you very, very much, Kate, and I really wish to express to Cigna my great appreciation for allowing me to come and present with you all and to share a bit about eating disorders, particularly today and this week as it is National Eating Disorders Awareness Week. So of all the weeks I get to be a participant with you all, it is a great privilege indeed to share this week as people across the nation are working to increase knowledge and advocacy for eating disorders. I have been asked to speak specifically about the inherent complexities of the refeeding process in eating disorder treatment. We're going to go through a few basic elements about eating disorders and head into the refeeding process and clearly at the end leave some time for some questions. So I do hope that you'll take some notes along the way if something seems confusing or if something you might want to know a little bit more about. Please, I hope you'll take the time to ask because those are very, very important. Again, my name is Chase. I am the Vice President and Chief Clinical Officer at Veritas Collaborative, which is a new center, an inpatient residential and partial hospitalization program for young women and men with eating disorders in Durham, North Carolina. You can read a bit on, I believe, on your screen, a bit about me and my work in eating disorders. I am a certified eating disorder specialist that's credentialed by the International Association of Eating Disorders Professionals. I am a founder, of course, of Veritas, the specialty behavioral health hospital for young people with eating disorders. I've recently been named a lead faculty on the International Association's course on core competencies for the treatment of eating disorders and the Medical Advisory Board for NORMAL, which if you haven't encountered yet, I really strongly encourage you to visit them on their website. It's a nonprofit organization that, on the heels of NIDA, is a wonderful, wonderful tool for eating disorders education and prevention and advocacy, all sorts of YouTube videos and other resources to help families as we work through these very devastating mental illnesses. Before I founded Veritas Collaborative, I was a founding clinician at Carolina House, a residential eating disorders treatment facility for women in Durham, North Carolina, and before that worked as a clinician for Duke University's Counseling and Psychological Services Body Image Concerns and Treatment Team. It is one of my favorite things to do in all of the land, to present to schools and to university faculties, as you see there, clinical staffs, to students, to families, and to members. So what we're doing today is part and parcel one of the greatest things I get to do. So I count this as an incredible privilege that you all have joined and are participating today. As you can see on the next slide down, you can see a little picture of Veritas, just to give you a little idea of where I spend my days. And then moving on, as we talk a bit about eating disorders, just baseline information. Some of this information you already know. Some of this information is not going to be news to you, and so do forgive me if it is redundant for you. For some of you, however, it is not new news, and so I do want to briefly go over some of these basics, and then we can use those as a launching point for further discussion or maybe for your further questions. On the slide entitled Eating Disorders, very simply at top, in bold, you'll see the phrase, eating disorders are the most lethal psychiatric illness. The most lethal psychiatric illness. It's not depression. It's not anxiety. It's not alcoholism or substance abuse or chemical dependency. It's eating disorder, technically anorexia nervosa being the major culprit, but in aggregate, all of eating disorders. The mortality rate for women with eating disorders is 12 times that of their peers. Now, we say two times anything is a lot. Something, you're twice as likely to get blah, 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 and we all go ooh and ah. But people aren't talking about the fact that this is is 12 times, not twice, but 1,200%. And the suicide rate, you'll notice, is 19 times. For suicide is one of the methods of mortality that happens a lot with eating disorders at the point where folks reach moments of just absolute despair, a loss of hope during the course of their illness. At least 20% of eating disorder folks will die. It says women here, but it's not only women, will die prematurely as a result of an eating disorder illness. And the average age of death due to an eating disorder is 34 years old. I don't know about you, but when I read those statistics, and certainly have been to a fair number of funerals of young men and women who have suffered from this illness, and I have been to too many, and it really does take a toll on bodies, and which is one of the reasons we're going to focus on the refeeding process today. Eating disorders are, and this is, you know, if I could have found a way to make this flash and shine, I would have on this bullet point here. The eating disorders are complex mental illnesses, very, very complex mental illnesses, and they exist at the intersection of the biogenetic predisposition, in other words, what comes to you through your genes. Temperament also comes to you. You inherit those sorts of things, as well as the environmental factors. A lot of people are engaged in an argument about whether it's all nature or it's all nurture. I'm one of those folks in the world that's going to say, well, that old nature-nurture argument is sort of over. It's always both. In fact, this emerging field of epigenetics, which is what I put down there at the bottom, is a sort of a new thing for all of us in the field that are working with eating disorders, which simply means that our environment and the way we behave begins to impact our genetic structure for both ourselves and those who will come after us. So what may not have been a predisposition at one point in our lives, if we behave in ways for long enough, it might very well become an issue of genetic predisposition in our lives. In this month's issue of the Academy of Eating Disorders International Journal of Eating Disorders, this very issue was brought to the fray really putting forward that eating disorders are complicated. They are not simply defined. And if anyone is coming to you and saying, oh, well, this is how an eating disorder starts, this is how it is mediated, this is how it is fixed, and this is the only way, we might want to take a step back from that. And in fact say these are really complicated illnesses that take a very skilled team of persons along with a very supportive family in order to treat. The next slide talks about the paucity of outcome studies. And basically what this wonderful slide is to show you is that there haven't been a whole lot of studies on eating disorder illnesses. Craig Johnson shared this slide with me as he put together a presentation to show just how few people had been studied with a randomized control trial, the golden standard for research in any field. And you'll see that the studies on treatment of eating disorders, particularly anorexia, there have been 19 studies since the beginning of time to date. And N, that N number means the number of people that were included in those studies, equals 896 in randomized controlled trials. That's it. Fewer than 1,000 persons have been studied when it comes to how efficacious treatment might be. For bulimia, there have been 38 studies, and fewer than 4,000 persons have been studied. When we move from treatment to outcome and course of illness, there have been 25 studies for anorexia, 13 for bulimia, and you can see that the numbers of persons that have been studied in total, are between 1,000 and 1,500. And I noted just in small print beside those numbers that a lot of that data was collected more than a decade ago. If any of you out there are researchers or interested in research or wanting to do more of it, I ask you, I beg you, please, go do it. Call me. My contact information will be on here. We'll find a way, because we certainly need a lot more literature to focus on eating disorders. Our next slide, also titled Eating Disorders, is a very, very basic explication of our diagnostic criteria for eating disorders. First, anorexia nervosa, which you all know often the main criteria of which is low weight, less than 85% of expected weight for height, and a very intense fear of food and weight gain. And then the other illness many people know about, bulimia nervosa, is where a person would binge or purge food in some way. Binging is required, in fact, for a diagnosis of bulimia nervosa to be made. And that generally is within a discrete period of time, eating somewhere between 3,000, 5,000, or 10,000 calories. And then purging that, compensating for that in some way by vomiting, by using laxatives or compulsive exercise. Eating disorder not otherwise specified is the third category, and interestingly enough, that's the category where the most fatalities from this illness arise. These are those illnesses that don't quite meet the criteria for one or the other that is most well known, but in fact is somewhere in between. We've been working with the Academy of Eating Disorders. Stacy McIntyre and I, the founders of Veritas, have really been working with the DSM-5 committee, and hopefully we'll see binge eating disorder added to the 2012 DSM-5. Some are hopeful for purging disorder, which is where a person might eat a normative amount of food, but then purge whatever normative amount of food was put in front of them. We have much more likelihood of seeing binge eating disorder put in the next diagnostic manual, which is what we use to, of course, diagnose patients, than we do purging disorder. But we do hope that within the next several years we'll see that added to the diagnosis. Why is this important? Because having some words to describe what these illnesses are leads us to more research. It leads us to being able to understand, explain, and talk about these illnesses. One last thing I'll say about this slide is that a lot of folks believe that persons with anorexia nervosa do not binge and purge. And I just want to make sure that everyone knows that there are subtypes to each of these categories. And anorexia nervosa, of course, has subtypes, one of which is binge-purge subtype, which means that these persons are not only underneath their expected weight for height, but also binging and purging. And for those of you out there who have family members or know of persons who may be struggling with that particular issue, please do know that that is one of the most serious forms of eating disorder mental illnesses and should be taken very, very seriously. If low weight plus the compensatory behaviors of vomiting, laxative, exercise, or any other kind of purging is happening, intervention is really, really indicated as quickly as possible with an expert team. Moving along to our next slide just a simple statement. Eating disorders are underserved and they're undertreated, and an inadequate treatment equals a death sentence for our loved ones and our patients. There are a lot of folks out there who hang a shingle and who will say that they are eating disorder specialists, and that simply just isn't true. It takes a great deal of education and learning about eating disorders in order to really be qualified to treat these very complex illnesses, and there are very few treatment options that are best practice in the United States. We hope to add to that, but we know that there are a lot of other wonderful folks, outpatient clinicians, intensive outpatient networks, residential centers, and other inpatient hospitals and organizations who are adding to options for treatment for patients across the United States. However, due to the fact that there are not very many places for children, adolescents, and young adults, their families, etc., to go and access care, folks often wait too long to intervene. It's in that waiting too long to intervene that leaves our family members vulnerable to what I call a poor prognostic outcome, which means they need to come into a level of care as our center might provide, or other centers like Laureate or Eating Recovery Center or any number of other centers might provide. We believe that prevention is a very important part of what we do. We are certainly glad to treat folks, but I'd rather work myself out of a job. I'm glad to be a florist or something else than an eating disorder professional if we can find a way to prevent other folks from developing these illnesses. The next slide says, but my son or daughter is on full scholarship, and so how can these delusions, these ideas of the mind that I might be inappropriately sized, how does that come to be? What we know now that we did not know some years ago about this illness and these illnesses is they very truly are delusional illnesses, and the definition of delusion being a fundamental loss of perspective. However, we know that folks with eating disorders really do often function incredibly well outside of body weight, food, size, shape, appearance, in academics, and some relationships, and some in sports, and all in friendship activities, do quite well. But in that one area of food, weight, body shape, size, and image, there is a serious and true delusion. And again, we call those circumscribed delusions because it does not pervade necessarily the entire mind, just that particular part. However, that being said, it does affect all of those other parts of one's life. Whereas a person with an eating disorder might not have a delusion about school or about a relationship, I can tell you that the illness itself will wreak havoc upon schoolwork and relationships and family dynamics. So whereas the delusion may be circumscribed, the effects of it are much more daunting and pervasive. Anorexia, of course, affects the whole body. You see on the next slide there. Some of this is very clear, and hopefully you can see this clearly on your screen, how it affects the brain. In fact, through dehydration, much of the brain shrinks because your brain is made of fat and water, and if you are restricting fat and water, then the brain will also shrink. We can restore some of it, but in the earlier stages of development for a young adult, a child or a young adult, some of the parts of the brain may not be able to restore as appropriately as it, you know, would in later onset. So really, really getting in there earlier and intervening fast can be very important for long-term brain health. Hair falls out. There are lots of issues related to the heart we're going to get to in a minute about low blood pressure, slowing heart rate, also known as bradycardia, heart palpitations. There are certainly issues related to anemia, the weakening of muscles, the issues of kidney and kidney failure, electrolyte concerns. Actually, electrolyte concerns much more an issue in bulimia than anorexia, and clearly issues related to hormones and to skin. Interestingly enough, with one's skin, of course, it dries very easily because of the lack of water. And also, some of you may be familiar with the concept of lanugo, which is where soft on baby-like fur or fuzz might grow on one's arms, particularly arms and legs. Babies are born with lanugo as a way to help keep folks warm. And folks with anorexia nervosa have a very difficult time thermoregulating, keeping their body warm. And the lanugo assists them in being able to keep their bodies alive and warm. The next slide talks about BMI, about that expected weight for height. And I put the image there, says I have approximate knowledge of many things. And the BMI, the body mass index calculation, is no different. It is not a perfect gauge. It is not a perfect system. It is a general gauge that we use to help assess where a person might be in terms of expected weight for height. Dietitians and clinicians that treat this illness know that they must include information about families and family history and growth chart and gender and any other developmental factors that might be at play, where a person might be in puberty and in development. That makes an incredible difference, as well as genetic variables. And so just a number and just a height, in other words, a weight and a height together, that's not quite enough. So just FYI, know that BMI is a general calculation. However, The next slide will show you how we use BMI, how it's calculated. The body mass index was created in the 1800s by a Belgian scientist named Adolf Quetelet, and it still remains WHO, the World Health Organization, standard for gauging weight to height proportions. And you can see the complicated formula of BMI equals mass times 703 over height inches squared. Let me tell you something. Even though I have to, as an eating disorder specialist, be able to rattle that off, I go online and Google BMI calculator and let the internet do that work for me, mostly because that takes a while to do it, pen to paper. And you can see, based on the scale, what would be noted as underweight, within normal limits, somewhat over normal limit, and then into the obese category. The next slide talks about anorexia nervosa's impact on the body, and we've gone over some of this already, so I'll very just briefly say a couple of extra things, such as osteoporosis or osteopenia, which is the precursor to osteoporosis. Oftentimes, we'll experience patients who will be, of course, fatigued regularly, who have syncope episodes or otherwise known as fainting, and have overall weakness. And some of these other issues have been discussed in the former slide. The anorexia nervosa in the brain slide is particularly important. And that's this. There is a loss of gray matter mass. As I said earlier, the brain is made of water and fat. And so we actually lose brain mass. Your brain, a person with anorexia and sometimes bulimia nervosa, will lose mass. That means that all of those receptors like serotonin and dopamine, those pleasure and pain and reward receptors become impaired because they are not—they're no longer the same size. They are not—they come serotonin and dopamine, though it might be released in the same quantity as it was before. It might override the receptor, which is now shrunk. So it really impacts how we are able to feel about ourselves. Now, one might think, okay, well, that's great. My brain has shrunk, therefore I have more serotonin, because the serotonin levels are the same in the brain, and therefore I feel great. Well, not exactly. Actually, the serotonin can go into what we call extracellular regions of the brain, places where serotonin is not supposed to go. And when it goes into those areas, it can make persons who are refeeding feel really, really horrible, nauseous, headaches beyond all imagination, as in worst migraine you might have ever felt, those of us that have had migraines before. It really can, for some folks, lead to a very, very painful experience during refeeding. Now, when a person has been, as you see, Walt K., in Psychiatric Times, about a year ago, I suppose, noted, when individuals with anorexia nervosa starve, extracellular serotonin concentrations diminish, resulting in a brief respite from a dysphoric mood. In other words, that serotonin, which there was so much of that was in the wrong place, when they starve themselves again and restrict caloric intake, they can get rid of that horrible, nauseous, terrible feeling and start to feel better. And so in some ways this is a way for us to hold on to empathy for our patients because their brain is not helping them in that moment. It is not being very kind to them and making actually restricting food feel good. Cortisol levels, cortisol you may have heard of before, is anxiety part of the body, hormone. Those levels increase as weight or body mass decrease, and that makes the central nervous system impaired, and higher anxiety tends to occur because of that. The next picture are pictures of brains from a functional MRI scanner, and what would a presentation on eating disorders be if I didn't show you a picture of the brain? And so you'll look at the control subject brain on the left and the person with anorexia, their brain on the right. And you can see that when they are given tasks, this is sort of a they're under the scanner that's looking at different parts of their brain and the brain activity. Now, when they are given a complicated task, what parts of the brain light up? Now, we all know the brain doesn't actually light up, but in what we see as activity going on in the brain. And you can see that when complicated activities are given to a control person, in other words, someone without an eating disorder, many different parts of the brain are activated to use and to get through those complicated activities. And the person with anorexia, to look at the picture on the right, you can see that it is an incredibly minimal amount of the brain that is functional. We call this set shifting and executive functioning deficits. They have a very difficult time, anorexic patients, being able to manage complicated activity. The next slide shows you two of the tasks that we might present to test for this. The first being the Wisconsin card sorting test, where we ask persons to pair cards by color. Now I want you to pair cards by how many objects are on the card. Now I would like to pair shapes on the card, and we can make a number of determinations about how functional the brain might be there. To its right, the Ray Ostrich complex figure test. A person is shown that figure for a number of minutes, and then it's taken away from them, and a blank piece of paper is put in front of them, and that person is asked to redraw that figure. Now, I have attempted this test on a number of occasions. I have yet to get it anywhere near perfectly. I can tell you that, because it is remarkably complicated. However, one thing that helps us know a little bit more about what's happening in the brain is that folks without eating disorders generally draw the big box first when they have the blank sheet of paper in front of them. They might draw the big triangle. They might draw the line down the middle. But a person, particularly a person with anorexia nervosa, will start drawing the very, very small lines, the football kind of lines on the page. They might draw the smiley face. They might draw the sort of plus sign toward the bottom, or the little diamond dangling from the front. The detail orientation, this is what helps us understand the connection between obsessive compulsive disorder, anxiety disorders, and eating disorders. I'm going to breeze through a few of these because of time reasons, but the next slide just gives you a few keywords to talk about temperament and anorexia nervosa, and these may be incredibly familiar to you. Folks with anorexia are often harm avoidant. Some have used the term neurotic. In other words, another synonym for that is just below it, being very, very obsessional, anxious, reward dependent, waiting on praise, perfectionistic, low novelty seeking, meaning they're not going to be the folks going to jump out of an airplane, with absolutely abysmal self-esteem. The next slide talks about deficits in the social neurocognitive process. That's this bunch of words that basically mean that folks with eating disorders, particularly anorexia nervosa, have difficulties particularly with interpersonal relationships, up to 20% of anorexia nervosa patients meet criteria for Asperger's disorder. And there is out there what's called the theory of the mind. And that's the theory of mind is the ability to understand the thoughts and intentions of others and take on others' perspectives. And persons with anorexia nervosa, and now we know bulimia nervosa, have significant difficulty understanding the intentions of others. And treatment, what we provide, is to help patients see both the forest and the trees. And you can see that I give great credit to Ken Weiner and Rick Bishop and others for some of this information. The next slide, the just eat a sandwich approach. If only it were that easy. I have heard this line so many times. Our patients have heard this line so many times. Our families have heard this line so many times. Oh, this girl, oh, this boy just needs to eat. And, I tell you, there's very few things in the world that make my blood boil more than that. Now, I realize that that often comes out of a place of not having information. You don't know what you don't know. But as my father would say, you know, when you don't know what you don't know, and then you find out that you can know, now it's time to get to knowing. So let's get to knowing. Actually, if we were to just take that philosophy, but just eat a sandwich for someone who is severely undernourished, that would likely harm them more than it would help them. To just eat a normative portion of food after, say, reducing caloric intake to 50 or 100 calories per day, which is often what we see in our treatment center, sometimes 500-700 calories a day. And if that person were to go from 50 to 150 calories per day to a 1,750 or 2,000 calorie or what have you meal plan a day, that would be dastardly and potentially deadly. And what we call this process is refeeding. It's a process of helping that person become nourished. But if it is done too fast and not done appropriately, it can cause what we call refeeding syndrome. And I will give you today the overbearing clinical word of the day, hypophosphatemia. Hypophosphatemia is, and I give credit to Julie O'Toole at the Cartini Clinic for a wonderful explication of what this is. But hypophosphatemia is when a malnourished patient suddenly takes on food, glucose, sugar, starches, into the body. And the body reacts to this by releasing insulin into the blood. And you would think, oh, well, this is great. Well, this actually causes a chain reaction where that phosphorus goes from that's just been in the body fluid where it ought to be, and the cells just take it up and suck it up from all of the fluid that goes through both central nervous system and all the way through the body. It sucks up all of that phosphorus into the cells because they have been so malnourished, these cells, and they need the phosphorus. But so does the body fluid. It needs it. And so the sudden shift of phosphorus from the body fluid being stolen into the cells causes weakness and inability to breathe. Often it can cause seizures and convulsions, a confused mental state, and frankly, and this is the most worrisome part, eating even a cardiac arrest. Unlike electrolyte imbalances that occur from vomiting or laxatives, the unique thing about hypophosphatemia is that it can worsen with refeeding. And so medical oversight is absolutely critical because we can prevent that part of the recovery process, this very, very difficult, very, very dangerous part of the recovery process, if we just know enough to take labs and to see how much, how much phosphorus is in the serum, in blood serum. If we were able to do that, then we have a shot at giving appropriate doses of phosphorus, and that can be taken a number of ways, by pills, through IV, whatever is needed, and we can completely avoid that part of the refeeding syndrome. So the just eat a sandwich approach is one that, you know, I want us to, my mother would often watch the No Whammy show. No whammy, no whammy, no whammy. No, this is definitely a whammy. Let's not do that. Because if we do that, we very much risk seizure convulsions and most notably cardiac arrest. You can see that under refeeding syndrome, I've sort of put some other things about hypophosphatemia under there, and that phosphorus is needed for oxygen transportation, so therefore, without it, parts of the body begin to shut down. And when phosphorus is not in the body, not enough of it, and it's not just phosphorus, it can also be magnesium, potassium, what have you, when those aren't available, and the body will begin to seek nutrition from itself. And frankly, it's going to look for wherever it can find fat and protein. The brain is one area, and muscles are another, which is why muscle wasting is a part of anorexia nervosa. Many of us have either seen or know about, and it's a very important part. I want to go on to the next slide that says, so just bulk up completely on phosphorus and just, absolutely give them, you might call it a bolus. Let's just give them bowls and bowls full of phosphorus or bags and bags through IVs. Not so fast. We know through the Minnesota semi-starvation experiment in 1945 that was conducted by conscientious objectors. Actually, they were the participants in the study, is that, of course, again, be careful about giving too many carbohydrates too fast, because it can lead to a number of other issues of severe damage to the body, edema, anemia, and then, of course, at the very end, you see yet another explication of hypophosphatemia. So we really have to be careful about this process of refeeding. It's not just let's just go back on a normative eating plan. You have to wait. The next slide says, but wait, isn't that what we wanted? The red blood cells have to have more phosphorus, etc. I tell you, when a person starts to refeed, when they start eating again, after having restricted for a longer period of time, edema is going to occur almost instantaneously. And you might want to think for a minute why this would be a particular issue for a population of anorexia nervosa. If parts of their body begin to swell, we're talking about a population that has difficulties with body weight, shape, size, and appearance. So edema, it's often one of the reasons people stop treatment and recovery is because immediately their size changes. They can't do it. The mental illness just takes a hold of them. And so the recovery process can often stop, which is one reason that a community of supporters, parents, and of therapists and nutritionists and medical providers and psychiatrists together really need to be in on taking care of these patients. The demand on the heart becomes excessive. Acute heart failure is a considerable risk, and the respiratory system is overloaded because carbon dioxide production becomes very high, oxygen very low, and breathing can become slow. And that is the last thing we need while we're doing the refeeding process, is for breathing to become slow. We need more oxygen, not less of it. Also, GI system. I can tell you that during refeeding, the GI system has incredible difficulties with quote-unquote a jolt of having not eaten in some period of time, or having eaten only liquids, or having eaten only a very small amount. The stomach will actually atrophy. Much of the GI tract can do that during starvation. And the gut isn't prepared to handle the sudden intake of food. And this can cause remarkable constipation. It can lead to cathartic colon. Some experience it with diarrhea. Whereas the GI system, motility, some of you may know it as motility issues, the food is not moving through the system. And that is also a very life-threatening condition. If it doesn't move, what do you do? Particularly, what do you do for folks who have been addicted to laxatives? You have to be very careful. It's not as simple as adding, a stimulant laxative to help that move along. I'm realizing and looking at the time that we have very, very little time left, so I want to just get to a few brief points and breeze through the rest. So what to do about this conundrum, the slide is called. Intentional, individualized nutrition progression is key. I'm going to say that again. Intentional, individualized nutrition progression is key. Now, some would say, well, we'll start with 800 to 1,200 kcals, which is another word to say calories. To start with, we'll monitor the electrolytes and the phosphorus. We'll increase 200 to 300 calories every 2 to 3 days. That generally is something that is acceptable, and we know that is not going to be overly damaging. With a goal of 2 to 3 pounds per week. More than that can be dangerous. Less than that can lead to poor outcomes. However, I want to tell you this. Very recently, the academic literature, and when I say very recently, I mean only a few months ago, the literature suggests that if a young person or even an older person is in a closely monitored environment, we can increase that level of caloric intake more frequently, more rapidly, without as much risk of cardiothoracic concern and heart failure. So there's still some debate out there in the community. However, we do know that we might actually be able to help weight restore these folks more quickly without danger, as long as we're monitoring the appropriate labs we need to be monitoring, paying attention to the edema, paying attention to what the patient and their families are seeing and saying. It's very important. The next slide is simply a BMI classification that we can skip around. Doing the math is a slide that might help you as you're trying to calculate, well, what might a length of stay look like if you were going, if you were going into treatment. And you need to know about how long it might take. That's just a chart for you. Treating the outcome is something I'm very committed to. Do note that the risk of relapse doubles if an anorexic patient is discharged from treatment from whatever level of care, less than 90% of ideal body weight. Doubles if they're discharged less than 90% of ideal body weight. And every bit above the 90%, as we approach that 100% ideal body weight, we reduce that risk of relapse. So we are very, very, very adamant about trying to get as close as possible to that 100% IBW. In many cases, we'll say it's like getting on if you have a fear of an elevator, for example, your therapist wouldn't take you to the lobby of the elevator and say, okay, you've done your work. See you later. Thanks. Instead, they would get on the elevator and ride it with you. It is that 100% number that is the greatest fear. The multidisciplinary approach, clearly I've spoken to earlier, that I believe it does take a community to intervene, particularly in the more severe forms of illness, inclusive of psychiatry, internal medicine, psychotherapy, family therapy is going to go in there, dietetics, and specialized nursing. And then I use a second slide simply to say, no, seriously, use this multidisciplinary treatment team. And you have before you what each of those disciplines can do, what each of those disciplines does to be able to be assistive to you and your family as you're managing the complicated illness of anorexia nervosa. There's a lot going on, and it's more than just one person with one skill set ought to track. I'll skip the next one because that was just about the elevator phobia there. You'll note that eating disorders clinicians, the folks that you seek out to be assistive to you in treating these illnesses, must be advanced generalists in other diagnoses. Because if you look, okay, anxiety and depression, actually the number now is closer to 70%. You're going to find that in eating disordered patients. 70% are also going to have a diagnosis of anxiety and depression, 40% of OCD, more than a quarter of substance abuse issues, PTSD, and somewhere between 40 and 60%. So if these clinicians, particularly psychotherapists and psychiatrists, don't know how to deal with those issues as well, probably not the greatest idea for them to be working with eating disorders patients. The next point here I just wish to make for you is that second, I suppose it's, there's only one bullet, but it's the second hyphen down, that nature versus nurture debate is old news. Anorexia is as heritable as schizophrenia and bipolar disorders. And actually, these disorders might lie dormant in the brain until they're switched on. And what switches these disorders on, we believe, I say we believe because we need more research, are the behaviors of restricting calories or purging or compulsive exercise. When you compound those with the hormones associated with puberty, that can often be the trigger that turns the illness that otherwise was asleep in the mind. One of my patients drew a picture of a sleeping dragon attached to a brain, and another picture that showed that dragon breathing fire. And that has stuck with me as a very clear image of what folks with anorexia and bulimia go through. The next slide are a few of the wonderful, wonderful, great folk who are researchers out in the field. And again, any of you interested in research, please talk to Craig Johnson, Cindy Bulick, Nancy Zucker, Walt Kay, some of the world's finest researchers in eating disorders. They know a great deal, and we owe a great deal to them. I'm going to skip through a couple of these slides here. Mostly the rest of these slides have to do with bulimia nervosa. We do have some issues in refeeding with bulimia nervosa simply because of the reflux. The body gets so accustomed to vomiting for those persons who for whom vomiting is their compensatory behavior. That vomiting can sometimes become almost automatic. I take that back. Not almost automatic, automatic. So when they're eating food, the body is accustomed to regurgitating that food. And being very cautious not to shame a person, a loved one, someone we might know, when that occurs, particularly during the first parts of recovery, is very, 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 very important. A few other things you might see are swollen glands, swollen parotid glands on the sides of the face. That often happens when folks have been restricting fluids and also have been engaging in vomiting behaviors and then stop the vomiting behaviors. The parotid glands are what produce saliva. So if the person is starting their recovery journey, their body has heretofore been producing a whole lot of saliva to assist with the purging behavior. And when a person stops that in the recovery and or refeeding process, those parotid glands aren't quite ready to stop, and so they continue to produce lots and lots of saliva, and they store them. And it is a very, some of my patients have called it chipmunk cheeks, because they can swell rather large in size, which for, again, people with body weight, shape, size, and appearance issues is quite the damning issue indeed. I invite you to read some of these other issues that are related to refeeding, particularly issues in recovery with bulimia nervosa as a super secret illness, some things that you might look for, sneaking away the scarring on the knuckles from the stomach acid and vomiting, the hiding of food, the disappearance of food. And just as we talked about temperament and anorexia, there's also a temperament in bulimia nervosa, novelty-seeking, quick-tempered, excitable, not risk-averse. These people will be the folks to be the first to jump out of the plane. I'm wanting to skip forward here to slide number 43. Some of that other slides can be used and read by you a little bit later. I want us to make sure that we get our expectations in order, and this is important for the conversation. And just paying attention to the yellow line that says full recovery. I hope you can see the yellow line. If you cannot see it in color, it is the lower line. Assuming adequate care, the probability of full recovery over X number of months is, if you'll notice what happens in that lower line, it's flatlined for the first almost 24 months. So we need to get our expectations and our heads around what full recovery might mean. Partial recovery is what's above that, and that does take place a little bit more quickly. But in terms of what we might expect of our loved ones, the data indicate that, you know, a full recovery, which would be at the top of the list, sort of the 80% range, you know, doesn't occur until about 100 months out. As we begin to approach that, and so just keep that in the back of your mind as you think about recovery. It is possible. I believe in it. I wouldn't do what I do unless I have seen thousands upon thousands of young women and men survive and thrive when given adequate access to outpatient or inpatient care, whatever it is that they might need. The slide 44, three serious points. Number one, eating disorders are serious mental illnesses with mental and physical consequences. Number two, parents who have children with eating disorders have been imprudently implicated for far too long. We used to call them, we always used to blame it on the mothers back in mid-century. We called them anorexigenic mothers. They were causative. We know better now. And the Academy of Eating Disorders has put out position statements that say, we know this is not your fault. And another serious point, number three, is that adolescents, young adults, and adults and their families wait too long to receive adequate care. And this is a serious risk for lethality and in terms of being able to intervene and make that refeeding process not nearly so scary. For your own information, as you peruse the next few slides, you can see what the levels of care are in eating disorders as established by the American Psychiatric Association. You can see why outpatient care might not be enough for some patients if the labs prove that the illness is rather advanced or the behaviors do. And also the threshold for intervention simply means this first quote I'm going to read to you because I believe it is very, very important. The Society of Adolescent Medicine and put out in 2003 and stands by this statement. Because of the potentially irreversible effects of an eating disorder on physical and emotional growth and development in adolescents, the high mortality and the evidence suggesting improved outcome with early treatment, the threshold for intervention in adolescents should be lower than adults. That means when you start seeing behaviors, it's already time to intervene. It's very, very important. This last slide here is just something we do in our program. Many other programs also will do this when a patient may need to come into a higher level of care, is not to simply give them a tray and say, here's the food that we've established for you, but instead to get the patients actually in the kitchen, moving those patients toward self-sufficiency with food, toward cooking, toward portioning, toward handling, toward baking, toward preparing. They, with executive chefs and sous chefs in the kitchen, are learning to engage and interact with food in new ways they had not before, which also becomes assistive at home because it is normative for a 14-year-old as well as it is for a 25 or a 50-year-old to be able to prepare lunch for school or for work. I've given you some other resources further down in the slide so that you can go read for yourself. Some of these are technical. Some of them are incredibly easy to read through and get the various points of. And you have my contact information, and I offer myself to you as a resource. Whether or not you send patients to Veritas Collaborative is not my concern. I am mostly concerned with making sure that patients get access to care. Cigna has proven over and over that they want to make sure that patients do have access to quality care, and whatever I can do to help facilitate that, call me. It takes a community, and it is, as a clinician, I believe, our ethical duty to help folks find resources in their local area or beyond to make sure that their loved ones are cared for. I realize now, as I look at my clock, that I have gone over by 5 minutes and not left the time for questions as I was instructed. And so, number one, wish to apologize for that as my own error, and see if, number one, if there's time for any questions, and if there is, what they might be, and if not, of course, please do contact me directly. So I turn it back over to you, Kate.
Okay, and actually, if there are callers still on the line, our call center is going to go ahead and go through a brief survey, at the end of which you'll have a chance to ask questions.
Okay.
Thank you. To help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you're a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in this survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. After I finish reading the entire question and all of the possible responses, please answer by pressing the star key followed by the number that corresponds to your choice. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Okay, our first question. This session provided me with an understanding of how anorexia and bulimia affect the human body. Star 1 for strongly agree. Star 2 for agree. Star 3 for disagree. Star 4 for strongly disagree. Our second question. This session educated me on the risk factors during the treatment and recovery process. Star 1 for strongly agree. Star 2 for agree. Star 3 for disagree. Star 4 for strongly disagree. third question. Overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. Star 4, strongly disagree. Question 4. I would recommend this program to others. Star 1, if you agree. Star 2, if you do not agree. And our last question. Please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. Number 1, I am an individual with an eating disorder. Number 2, I am a family member of someone with an eating disorder. Number 3, I am a health professional. Or number 4, other. And that does conclude our polling session. And now we will take questions. If you'd like to ask a question on today's call, you may do so by pressing star 1. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Please be aware that a voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open. At that point, please state your name before posing your question. Once again, press star 1 to be placed in the queue. And it appears there are no questions at this time. I'd like to turn the conference back over to our speakers.
Okay. Well, thanks, everyone, so much for attending, and thank you very much to Chase for providing such wonderful insights for us today. If you have any specific questions about any of the therapies discussed today, please contact the Eating Disorder team at Cigna by calling the number on the back of your insurance ID card. And please also be sure to mark your calendars to join our Eating Disorder Awareness Seminar next month on Tuesday, March 27th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time.
That does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation.